Well, I'm very happy to welcome you here in the facilities of the Collège de France, a very old institution. We will celebrate the 500th anniversary within a decade, so it gives you an idea. And we are very much honored, very proud. I want to thank Jim for having this idea of concentrating so and such a human capital here in this building. Jim will introduce the debate, and especially from the point of view of the conceptual framework, let's say, and then I'll make a presentation which will be much more data-based, I would say. It will illustrate and to some extent confirm the intuitions of Jim, Jim's intuitions, and Jim's theories. And then Philippe will add some his own words and in his
Christian and Leo.
Yeah, and we'll have a discussion with the room. So Jim, the floor is yours.
Yeah, no, everything is being filmed here today, so just be aware of that. And I want to echo Francois' welcome to everyone. When we set this up or started this idea, I intended for it to be more like a seminar setting or workshop setting, but here we are in the Collège de France, you know, in this absolutely beautiful amphitheater, which so far seems to be quite well air-conditioned. And as I said last night, it is, in French I call it la malédiction texane. It's the Texas curse. Every time I come to Europe, I'm expecting it to be nice and cool and raining. And here we have Texas-like weather, hot, very hot. So, but we are, I think most of you in this room have participated in one or more editions of this book. There are a few exceptions. I see someone out there shaking their head. But for those of you who are joining us for the first time, you know, sit back, listen, and sharpen your intellectual tools here to help us work on the fourth edition of this book. So, and I'm not going to give you a full history of the project, but it started with a National Science Foundation grant in the beginning of the 1990s. My old friend and colleague Wayne Cornelius was running a graduate seminar at the University of California, San Diego. They were reading an article that I had written in 1986 in the Annals, and they liked the idea in the article, and he said, let's have a project, a big project to compare immigration policies. Well, three editions later, this will be the fourth edition of the book. This book has been used widely around the world as a textbook, a reader on comparative immigration policy. So, for all of you in the room, I just want to remind you, and Phil probably will reinforce this point, that you know, we're writing this book for students and scholars, and we need to be aware of that so that we make sure that what we write is clear, and just think about how you would teach these different country cases to your own students. So to go to the project itself, here's just an outline of what I thought I would go over quickly today, and I'm not going to spend much time on this, but I think we do need to reflect just a little bit on the trends in international migration, and the question that is behind this project is, why do states have difficulty controlling immigration and integrating immigrants? I have an argument which has been around since the late 80s, early 90s, about what I call the liberal paradox. I want to talk to you a little bit about that. I want to come back and see if I can get us to reflect on national models and traditions of immigration. And there is, if you know the book, we divided countries into different categories: nations of immigrants, countries of immigration, latecomers to immigration. I think Francois is going to empirically try to demonstrate, you know, why that is a good typology. And of course, we all always have the old division between the U.S. and the Anglo democracies, the settler societies, and Europe. So First of all, trends. And, you know, I know you all have seen these data before, and I was thinking maybe that we'd have a few more people from the general public here, but I think we're mostly a pretty small group. But everybody knows that if you look at global migration, migration is the exception, not the rule. The vast majority of people in the world do not move. This is just simply the UN data looking at the numbers of people who are living outside of the country of their birth. It reaches barely 3.5% of the world's population. So I do think as political social scientists, you know, we really have to try to understand why we're in a crisis mode. My colleague Dietrich Trenhardt, who is here years ago, told me that maybe it's a crisis in the head. I always attributed that quote to Dietrich, but he told me just not long ago that it was Helmut Schmidt who said that. You often get into the psychological crises. So, you know, for us who are political sociologists, political scientists, trying to understand this crisis mentality, I think is a big challenge, you know, for us as scholars. Again, this will look familiar to all of you, but this goes back to the 1980s in my own work. I would attribute a lot of this way of thinking about migration to my colleague Phil Martin, who's sitting over here, from whom I have learned probably more about this subject than anyone else I know. But we know the economists and demographers do try to help us understand migration. This has been going on for decades, that it's basically a function of markets, demand pull, supply push forces. I think everyone can understand that. But the sociologists and anthropologists bring to the table the importance of networks and family ties, and Pierre Bourdieu, the idea of social capital. Phil, you know, often is fond of saying that, you know, demand pull, supply push are like two poles of a battery. You know, you have to connect them, and that's the networks that really do that. The networks, of course, lower the transaction costs of lower the risks of migration. But this is where I come into the picture. I would argue that these are the necessary conditions for migration to occur. And for those of you who know my work on bringing the state back in, the sufficient conditions, I would argue, are legal and political. So again, to quote my colleague Phil Martin, he said, one of the things you did in your work early on is brought a new independent variable into the equation. We've got to focus on rights and understand rights and status. Under international law, I don't know if there are any international lawyers in the room here, but all states have the sovereign right to control entry, if not exit. Ari Zoldberg, the late Ari Zoldberg, who spent many years of his life here in Paris teaching in Sciences Po, I think there are students, Catherine and others, who studied with Ari. But he always pointed out, you know, you have a right to exit under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but having a right to leave your country is a pretty meaningless right if you don't have a right to enter another country. So, and the late Myron Wiener, you know, wrote a lot about the rules of entry and exit. Finally, of course, we have to remind ourselves that not all migration is voluntary. There is a lot of forced migration in the world, and that is covered under both the 1951 Convention and the 1967 Protocol. Everyone knows the principles of the convention, and we're up to close to 70 million people now, I think, of concern to the UNHCR. So a fair number of those 250 million people who live outside of their country, they have had to move, not by choice, but because they were forced to move. I actually put this together specifically for this group, because this little picture here, which for those of you who study political science, I'm sure you remember the great David Easton, the sort of Eastonian model of policymaking. That goes back to the 60s and 70s. But when you think about policy, you know, you have to think of it as taking place in three different phases in terms of the social inputs that come to making policy in a liberal democracy, the outputs of those policies, which in terms of immigration policy, they're either going to be more liberal, more open, or more restrictive, more closed. And finally, the outcomes of those policies. And, you know, Christian Jopke wrote a great commentary for this introduction. He will talk a little bit about this. But I talk about institutional linkages, the things that translate the inputs into outputs, and then, of course, the behavioral linkages. So if we're talking about a gap, you're looking at various kinds of gaps here. You know, and Christian made the obvious point, others have made it, that is immigration policy, is it really different from other policy areas? Every policy has unintended consequences, and there are lots of gaps. So I'm sure we'll be discussing this. But for those of you who are not in the book, the original editions of the book, this is this basic Estonian model, you know, which I put in an article in 1986, which was really the basis for a lot of this discussion. This is simply a picture. We went back and forth with Stanford about the cover of the last edition. Pia's in here somewhere. And finally, we came up with a cover that really does reflect, I think, you know, what we're talking about, the human dimension of this, with these kids with their hands through the barriers in San Diego and Tijuana. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but again, in deference to Christian, who probably will talk a little bit more about it, you know, if we're going to hypothesize about the gap itself is not a hypothesis, it's simply an observation, then we have to start thinking about how we theorize the gap and, you know, how much progress have we made conceptually. This is just a rough sketch of four different ways of thinking about the gap. You could just argue that it's really a function of markets, that we don't need to look much beyond markets to understand what's going on in immigration. If you can construct a good model of this, as the Roy model, Todaro, Barry Chiswick, and others, and including Phil Martin, there's a basic economic and demographic dynamic that drives migration. That would be one argument. And markets, as we know, it's very difficult for states to completely control or master markets. Markets have a life of their own. Then, of course, you have the sociological argument. I know sociologists have really sometimes torn themselves apart over this. Are we moving into a sort of a transnational world, a post-national world, where everything is driven by kinship networks and social capital? Alejandro Portes, who was one of my teachers, basically, was one of the first to put this forward. Everyone in this room knows Saskia Sassen, who also pushed very hard. She wrote a little provocative book called Losing Control, that states have simply, they're pretty helpless, you know, in the face of these market pressures. So are we, you know, look at Yasmin Soysal, are we moving into a world of universal personhood, as Yasmin put it? The third argument takes us back to economics and political science. This was our great colleague at the University of Texas, Gary Freeman, who came up with a basic political economy or factor cost logic that we have to explain this policy the same way we would explain any policy. It's a function of the play of interests in society. If you know the trade models for trade theory, and some economists in the room, can you simply take those trade models and apply them to the migration field and use this factor cost logic as a way of explaining why states are open or closed to migration? That would be one argument. It's a powerful argument. But when you boil this down, it's really a capture argument, that states are essentially captured by powerful business interests. That is why they remain open to migration, even though the public opinion surveys would say that people want migration controlled, they want it stopped, they want it restricted, but it's powerful business interests that keep migration going. Finally, my own argument, which I would say is much more historical and institutional, which is all of these other things are important, but we have to focus on this in terms of what I call a rights and markets dynamic. And this is a dynamic that has become much more powerful after the Second World War. Francois, we were in his office yesterday, and we were looking at some graphs, you know, showing how human rights, you know, kicked in and became such a such an important part of the story following the Second World War. So, you know, we can elaborate this model and talk about it as we go through the various country cases. But those are just four ideas, four hypotheses. To move a little more quickly here, if you look at the liberal paradox, again, this is an idea I put forward in the late 80s, early 90s, which is that if you look at the liberal state, the economic logic of any liberal society or liberal state or liberal economy is one of openness. That's true of trade. It's true for investment. Shouldn't it be true for people, for migrants? If you look at the European Union, obviously this is part of the so-called four freedoms. You know, one of them is the freedom of people to move and seek employment. But there's the political logic in the liberal state, which is one of closure. We have to protect the social contract. We have to protect citizenship and nationality. And I would go to the work of Michael Walzer, you know, in Spheres of Justice, I believe, where he talks about how critical it is to maintain a sense of civic belonging and support the civil society. And migration can undermine or undercut the civil society. Finally, you know, this is what I call a paradox. How can states or societies be simultaneously open and closed? You know, that is the balance. And this is a little bit of an innovation. And again, I'm hopefully we will all come back to this little picture here. It's a very simple picture, but I've discovered when I go around the world and around the US and give talks about migration, this really helps a lot of people, sort of the average citizen, to try to begin to understand why migration policy is so complicated. Christian raised the story, you know, how is it different from any other policy area? Well, I will argue, Christian, that it is very different. Because in a normal situation, when you're talking about immigration policy, you know, and people like Greta Brockman and others who participated in the policy-making process, I think, can understand this. You know, we're always concerned about markets. We're trying to figure out how many people do we need, you know, what skills should those people have, the mix of immigrant flows. And, of course, there's often a temptation among politicians to fudge the issue of rights and status. Let's bring people in as guest workers. Let's not give them any status. Let's not let them settle. You know, the old German Gastarbeiter program or the American Bracero program. But that's the normal debate. I mean, it's a healthy debate that goes on in every society. But when you begin to add these other dimensions to the story, if there is a security threat or a fear, as happened after 9/11 or the Paris attacks of a few years ago here, the security dimension can easily and quickly overwhelm the rights markets discussion. And of course, the perfect storm is when you add culture to the mix, the cultural dimension of this. You know, look at the rise of Islamophobia across the West. You know, this changes the dynamic, introduces a new, much more social, psychological dynamic into the equation. And of course, this is a multidimensional game, but it's happening on three levels. So not only is it a multidimensional game, it's a three-level chess game, because it's happening at the national level, the international level, and at the local level. So I just would conclude this particular picture by saying, I'd like to quote the former American politician, Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. I lived in Massachusetts for many years. Many of you remember Speaker O'Neill. And his comment was, immigration is political death. You know, it's such a complicated thing when you open up this Pandora's box. So a lot of politicians, I think, just want to bury this issue and not talk about it. This is a picture. Thank you, Francois, for really cleaning this up. It's much clearer, which is a vivid sort of picture that shows what we were talking about. In 1960, you can see all these young Italians waiting, I think, in the Munich train station. And the caption, of course, says, for 60 marks, you can buy yourself an Italian. You know, that was sort of the mentality. And if you look at the Bracero program back in the 40s and 50s, Phil Martin, who is, you know, studied American agriculture, that these workers are basically disposable. They're commodities. You bring them in, you use them for a year or two, and then you throw them away. But of course, as Max Frisch, the great Swiss novelist, writer, said, you know, we asked for workers and human beings, people came instead. So this shows you how migration is very different from other policy areas. I'm just going to conclude by bringing us back to this whole national model idea. It's still a controversial idea, especially among some of my colleagues in sociology and anthropology. You know, they've struggled for decades to get the nation and the state out of the way, to take it out of the picture. But it keeps coming back. It keeps rearing its head. You know, a lot of political sociologists have sort of split into two camps. You know, one saying, well, we should really downplay the state, deconstruct the state. And another group that says, no, the state is still very much with us. It's a very powerful force. Just to sort of draw a sharp contrast here, you might have Brubaker or Yapka on one side of this argument, people like Yasmin Soysal, David Jacobson, and others. But I'm going to let François talk a bit more about the nation versus countries of immigration versus the latecomers. So I'm going to conclude here. Again, this is all familiar to many of you. It just reflects what I was just talking about, some of the debates about national models, national ideals. I do want to interject one perhaps controversial point. I think it's important for every society to have a strong national ideal, national understanding, because I think it helps to make it easier when it comes to controlling or managing migration. Having a strong, powerful national model is important. It's a double-edged sword. I mean, the French have a very powerful Republican model, Republican ideal. After the Second World War, Germany struggled mightily to figure out what is the political myth, what is the founding ideal of the Bundesrepublik. And it used to be said that it's the Deutschmark that is the German national symbol, national flag. And I wrote many years ago about the importance of the Wirtschaftswunder. You know, the Germans using this idea of the economic miracle as a way of justifying allowing the Turkish guest workers and others to settle and to become citizens. And again, the old debates about whether we are looking at nations that are based more on the Kulturnation, the blood idea, or jus soli. Again, these are, I'm sure, will come up during our discussions. Again, just a picture to try to get our minds around this. Here we are in Paris, where there have been very ferocious debates about, how to integrate immigrants and how to control immigration. Finally, I'm not even going to get into this. This brings us back to something I've been working on for the past 10, 15 years, the idea that the modern state is a migration state. Somebody, I don't remember if it was Randall Hansen, who's somewhere in the room here, somebody said, well, every state is by definition a migration state. But I think the migration function, and I'll conclude with this note, the migration function has become absolutely critical for the modern nation state. You know, the state must protect itself. It's a security state. It's a garrison state. That's the nature of the Westphalian state. It takes on a more liberal dimension in the 18th and the 19th century following the American and the French Revolution. The state gets a bigger role in the economy, what Richard Rosecrans called the trading state. What I want us to do is think about the migration state. And this is simply a question about how states manage or control immigration for strategic purposes, for strategic gains, that migration has become very much a key element of the grand strategy of states. And states that fail in this function, they're at risk of becoming failing states. So migration is far more important, I think, today than it has been historically. The state is much, much more involved in this. So on that perhaps controversial note, I think I will stop and let François come up here. François is going to show us with data some of the things that I discussed. So thank you for this, and again, welcome to the workshop, and we're going to be discussing each of these countries that are in the book as we go forward. Thank you.
All
I'm just recalling here our program and the way we have divided, we have classified the different countries according to the plan that had been adopted in the previous editions. Mm-hmm. And so a nation of immigrants, countries of immigration, and latecomers. It's interesting to confront this classification with other that exist. For example, it's but an example, the OECD has recently, in his publication on the integration indicators, used a classification. The idea is that in order to understand how integration works, you need absolutely to have an idea of the context, of the historical context, and the kind of the relationship to migration, which can differ greatly from one country to another. So for the first type of country are settlement countries, and you can observe that the United States are no longer in this category. The US are in the long-standing destinations, and here OECD has made the difference between those who receive highly educated immigrants and are lower educated migrants, and you can see that US, UK, Switzerland, Luxembourg are in the first category, and Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, Belgium, France in the second one. And the destination with significant recent and humanitarian migration. Well, essentially Scandinavia, according to this classification. And then new destinations with many labor immigrants, and according to the skill level, Southern Europe is concerned, or the islands, Ireland, Malta, Iceland. Then emerging destination with small immigrant population, Turkey, Japan, and Korea are classified into this category. And finally, countries in which, well, it's not the people who moved, but the borders. Mm-hmm. And you observed it in the graph Jim has presented, the first graph, there was a change of the order of magnitude after the fall of the wall, which was entirely due to the creation of new states. And so the borders migrated, not the people. It's a well-known phenomenon. Now, our own classification of country, or maybe a provisional classification, I don't know, for this book, consists in attracting and drawing attention to the nations of immigration. With the idea that these nations have been built by immigration, whereas the countries of immigration are those countries. I have some doubt about this distinction. For example, the US, because of the application of the quotas of national origins, in the 50s, in the 60s, France, proportionate to its population, received more migrants than the US. Yeah. We were an immigration country more than the US during decades because of the quotas applied in the US. So it means that no nation is per se, essentially a nation of immigrants, or of course in the pioneering periods, but very soon the outsiders become insider, they acquire a mentality of insider, they reject the following outsiders and so on. They became, and the nativist movement is a clear illustration of this. Mm-hmm. And the immigrants themselves try to close the door behind them and so on. So this distinction between a nation of immigrant and a country of immigrant is, well, something relative. It has some sense, but not completely. And we can see that, for example, the Scandinavia is something apart. But I shall show some more signs, more precise signs about it. And here are the latecomers, according to our classification. But it merges, or it puts into the same categories, countries which are really have few immigration, are supposed to have few immigration, like Japan, if you don't take into account the interns who come year after year, and it's a sort of disguised migration, in fact, and we have this problem, and the Southern Europe. So the problem is, what should we do with the other country, for example, the Balkan country? If you take all the ex-communist Balkan countries, Romania, Albania, Kosovo, Serbia, Romania, 22% of the population of these countries is living abroad. Though they have a policy of emigration, I would say, but is it really a policy? It's a big question. We can see, of course, Poland, Hungary, etc., all these ex-communist countries in Oriental Europe, they do have a migration policy which consists in stemming all migrants. And we should certainly, maybe in the fifth edition, include special chapters dedicated to this policy or non-policy of migration. Okay. Now, I would like to comment two or three graphs. These graphs have been circulated in the Madrid conference, in the CS conference, but it's because to me it represents the outcomes. Yeah. At the end of the day, how many permits have this country have been issued in this country to newcomers? And what is interesting in this graph is that OECD, since a few years, has taken the decision not only to include the permits of stay, but also to make an estimate of the new residents which take advantage of the free circulation within Europe. Not only within Europe, it exists, for example, between New Zealand and Australia. And this is a gray zone. So here is the percentage distribution of, it's a flow. The flow in 2015, just at the eve of the crisis, before the migrant crisis. And then we'll see the impact of the crisis in the second graph. I will not comment in each country, but we, to some extent, we can see that Canada, Australia, New Zealand are really illustrating the selection of the migrant, the discretionary system of selection of migrant. And so the blue zone, the dark blue, corresponds to the laureates of this competition of the point system and the provincial additional programs. And the blue correspond to the families which are immediately taken with them. So it's not a reunification, it's a unification, a family unification, immediate unification. And if you take the example of Canada, it's more than 60% of the new residents which are selected through this device. How is it possible? Well, it has been imitated by Australia and New Zealand, but I must draw attention to the fact that Canada takes advantage of the existence of a big country, its unique neighbor at the southern border, 10 times more populated, which takes in charge the Hispanics, because the Canadian point system, in probability, statistically, eliminates most of the Hispanics. And so this solution cannot be generalized. And a solution that cannot be generalized raises an ethical problem. A solution cannot be a maxim for myself if it cannot be reversed and used by all the countries. So it cannot be a model. And it's not a coincidence if the other two countries which succeed in selecting the migrant to that extent are peripheral countries, Australia and New Zealand. France, for example, with all its continental borders, it would be absolutely impossible. We tried, Sarkozy tried to make immigration choisi. But it's not simply a decision taken by politicians or the adherents to a market economy. It has to do also with geography, with history, with the fact that the free rider system, okay, if the US are here to integrate Hispanics, we can select our own migrants. In the middle of the graph, you can see Sweden, and Sweden is a world leader in humanitarian immigration. It's a huge proportion, 36%, so the green area. And you can see, for example, if you look at France as compared to Germany, we have some selected skilled workers since the Sarkozy reform to a limited extent. It's nothing comparable to Canada, of course, but well, we have something of that. But we are, in Europe, the champion of the family reunification, and I will elaborate a little more about it because it may be misleading. And in comparison with Germany, only 34% of our new residents come from the other EU member states. We are not as attractive as Germany. You can see that Germany, 62% of the new residents come from Central Europe. This is essentially due to the influence area of Germany, to the geographical position of Germany among the new in Middle Europa, while France finally is a peripheral country, but UK is even more. But UK has succeeded in attracting all these Polish people, Hungarians, etc. But they have reacted against it by the Brexit, as you know. So we could comment this graph. What is interesting in this graph, when you try to systematize this kind of data, thanks to OECD, it raises new questions, of course. And this is it helps you to answer some questions, and it raises new ones. Now, let's see what happens in 2016, 1 year later, at the bulk of the crisis, of the migrant crisis. And you can see that things have changed, but in order to see it better, I suggest to give to each stripe a thickness which is proportional to the number of migrants. Mm-hmm. And so the surfaces are significant in this new, and it gives you an idea of the not only the proportion in the horizontal axis, but also an idea of the volumes that are dealt with. You can, and these are 1,000. For example, 680 means that in one year, everywhere in the world, 80,000 people were granted a title, a permit of stay for family reasons in the United States. It's a huge number. France, a little more than 100, more than Germany, much more than UK, only 30,000. And this is a big question, because the rights, the corner of the rights, or the axis of the rights, mm-hmm. How can we explain that countries so close, neighboring countries, submitted in principle to the same international conventions, are using the family reunification principle in such a different way? This is really an enigma, and we have to solve it. And now let's look at the difference between 2015 and 2016. You can see, of course, that Germany has considerably augmented its receiving capacity for asylum seekers. It's very impressive, but not giving up the attraction power for the other EU members. In the United States, the number of family, important family reunification is a little bigger, but the reception of asylum seekers is not really, has not changed. It's quasi the same figure. And of course, the Netherlands, for example, as Netherlands are in the lower part of the, has increased in a considerable way the number of the reception of asylum seekers. And France is more or less the same. We have not been affected as a whole by the migrant crisis, very few. And this is in huge, in total contrast with all the public debate about the submersion, about the way we could be overwhelmed by migrants and so on.
This is grand remplacement.
Well, so let's have a look. Let's take stock. Let's try to take stock of the the way we've dealt, we have treated the asylum requests in these last years. If I take 2016, which is the center of the crisis, here are the absolute numbers, and you can see that Germany is so at the head of it, and I could not put it into the graph without cutting the bar. The number of applicants is 755 applicants, and nearly 60% of them have been granted positive decision, protection by the German authority, and France is the second place. But of course, we have to take into account differences of population, the sizes of the country. And if we do this, the picture changes completely. And here is, well, there is a first control, the control by per million population, per capita statistics. And we can see that Sweden, Germany, Austria, etc., are at the head of the number of asylum seekers who were granted a protection per million inhabitants. And Malta and Cyprus are inserted into the classification because of the Dublin regulation. They are under the pressure of the big European countries. They are exposed in first line, at the front line, to the arrivals of migrants. And so you have this big issue that normally the European system should be done in order to integrate, to harmonize the situation, but in fact, and to compensate for geographical inequalities. But if you reason in terms of spatial justice, as geographers say now, the Dublin regulation is doing exactly the opposite, widening the gap between the countries according to their geographical positions. You see that France is very low in the classification, 16th rank. And when I say that, in my country, to authority, nobody accepted the idea. We are absolutely convinced that we are one of the two or three first countries of immigration asylum acceptance in the UK. And UK is even worse. Spain, Portugal, etc., don't are not equipped to treat really the asylum request because they were for long in an emigration country and not an immigration country. And this explains why. And what is interesting, we are fascinated by Orban, by Hungary, but in fact, all the ex-communist countries, whether they have a liberal regime or an illiberal regime, all do exactly the same. They don't accept asylum seekers. So we are overestimating the importance of the political regime to explain the behavior. And this is a topic which we should except Bulgaria. And now if I make the second correction, taking into account the differences between GNI, it modifies a little the classification, but not that much. Okay, so it is interesting to see that OECD and the HCR have recently made a study about the non-humanitarian permits issued to asylum seekers. In fact, 96% of these permits are family permits. So instead of giving them the status of refugee, these countries give them a status of a family migrant on family ground. And more or less, this is the same classification as the first one. So it adds to the figures you have already seen. It is interesting to see that in the lower part, France, US, etc., they don't accept this this trick. There is a sharp separation between asylum, the asylum procedure, and the economic procedure, or the family unification. The ways, the routes, the procedures are completely separate. Just to give you a more dynamic idea of the way these different countries behave, let's just begin with four countries, and quarter by quarter, from in 2014 to up to now, and always correcting for population. You can see the rise of of Germany, etc. It's very clear. The impact, one quarter later, of the EU-Turkey treatment, etc. But if you add other countries, and you realize that, for example, Sweden and Austria, and especially Sweden, before Merkel's statement, had already they were specialized in welcoming refugees from the Horn of Africa, for example, and they were the only European country that was really doing this. And Austria also, and the Netherlands to some extent, participated into this movement before Germany. What is interesting is to see that Merkel's statement had been made in a period in which the German, the number of asylum seekers accepted in Germany was already increasing. You cannot see really a rupture. To some extent, she confirmed a movement that was already launched. And now, in the last, yes, we can see that France, UK, France remained to the ceiling, very close to the ceiling, which is completely opposed to the public wisdom by now. And in the last period, it's very clear, all the burden is resting on the shoulders of Cyprus, Greece, Malta, all these Eastern Mediterranean countries, very clear. Well, the comparison between refugee welcomes in the United States and European Union, it's a very different, but I cannot elaborate. Here is an attempt, and it should be systematized. What is the staff, the personnel employed in the offices in charge of the asylum application? It's very different from one country to another. In Spain, for example, only 128 persons. With a stream of an inflow of migrants, which corresponds more or less to half of the French figures. In France, it's 1,800. In Germany, 6,000. And they consider that they are under-equipped in order to welcome them. So this makes very important. It's part of the migration policy. The investment you make in this legal equipment. And also, of course, the legacy of history plays a role in the importance you give to this equipment. And it has practical consequences, of course. And I think this is my last slide. And another example of the policy is the way we give citizenship of the host country to migrants. It is also very different from one country to another. So, yes, I'm confirming that in contrast with, for example, Saskia Sassen or this mainstream that was more or less explaining us that migration was sort of confrontation, direct confrontation between individuals considered as strategists or victims according to the orientation you had, and from the other side, super organization, multinational organization, with more or less the prophecy about the length, the death of the states. But in fact, all the migrant crisis has demonstrated us that yes, we have to put the state into the picture. So I hope I was not in contradiction with your statement, and I brought some.
Let's invite our commentators to come up and.
Thank you.
And talk about this.
Philippe, you want to?
And do you Phil? Want to give me 2 minutes?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, I'm Phil Martin. I want to thank Francois and Jim. I was asked just to say a few practical things here that didn't come out in the main chapters should be about 12,000 words. They should come in mid-September. The commentators don't have to be critiques of the chapters. You can critique them here, and then the author can make changes if he or she wants. But they can be extensions. The original, let me just go back. When the book was conceived in the early 1990s, remember that it was aimed at people who were born in the early 1970s. So what was 1970 in the United States? And it's mostly Americans, I might add. But what happened in 1970? 5% of the people in the United States were born abroad, right? The low point of everything. In the 1970s, we were marked by some oil price hikes in the economy, stagflation, women going outside the house to work for wages, some presidencies that first were Mr. Carter, and we had Nixon, we had the fight of the Vietnam. So in the early 1990s, when this book was originally conceived, the issue really was that we had passed immigration reform in the United States that failed in terms of stopping illegal migration. And 1989, we usually blame the Germans for Prop 187 because the Berlin Wall fell. And it's hard to remember now, but California had its worst recession in 50 years. I was serving on a federal commission at the time, going around with politicians a week a month holding hearings. And one of the things I learned is, I mean, politicians are not necessarily, some of them are pretty clever. And one guy, his way of looking at the relative economic attractiveness of various parts of the United States was to ask, what would it cost to rent a U-Haul? A U-Haul is a truck you drive yourself to move. What would it cost to rent a U-Haul to go between one city and another city? And to show you how much California was dependent on the defense industry, which crashed in the early 90s because there was no longer a threat from communism, in order to move from Los Angeles to Dallas cost you $1,000 for a truck. To move from Dallas to Los Angeles cost you $100. That is, the trucks were all leaving California and moving to Dallas. And so what was the big immigration issue? We had thought we stopped the illegal immigration. We hadn't. People came. We're coming at a time of the worst recession in 50 years. So the purpose then, as it were, of the book was to look at people born in 1970, going to college in the early 1990s, trying to understand how a nation of immigrants was blaming illegal migration, we used to say in California, for 10% of the state's budget. And passing then, 60-40, passing a proposition that said, unauthorized children should not be allowed to go to public schools. Now, granted, it wasn't implemented and stuff, but the context was different. Now we come today, now we're talking about people born in the year 2000. Okay, the year 2000, the U.S. was at its apogee. I mean, it was before the dot-com crash. Everything is different. What are the kids that are going to be reading these chapters thinking about? It's an era of terrorism. We fear terrorism. It's the rise of China. We're no longer number one, and China's eventually going to take over. It's the rise of asylum seekers. Sure, we all want global talent, but it's the rise of people who are moving from one country to another, coming in different channels, and having a huge rights versus other things debate. So I guess what I would urge you to think about is, it's great to write for your colleagues, but what we're really trying to do in this is help people in their early 20s who are thinking through these things, give them some analytic tools. Mm-hmm. And so while I'm sure we're gonna have a very interesting debate here over the next several days, I guess I would like to urge everyone to sort of keep in mind who the typical readers really are and how we help them think about the issues that they will then, in their 20 or 30 or 40 years down the road, be grappling with, and what kind of a framework we can give them to help think through these difficult questions. Let me stop there, and I look forward to interacting with many of you the next couple of days.